Good afternoon and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host, joining you from India. And we are talking about prostate cancer this afternoon on our 92nd episode. Our prostate cancer talks are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and the Prostate Cancer Foundation. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and we are talking to patient advocates to get a better insight into their roles in major clinical groups. We will also be addressing matters like training available, learning about evidence-based medicine and funding of clinical trials, and also explore the role of SWOG in recent major clinical trials. My co-host for the show is Mike Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific, not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. Mike works for Calcium, a privately held healthcare communication company based in Philadelphia. He is also a member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Rare Diseases and the International Myeloma Foundation. Mike is today talking to Tony Crispino, patient advocate to the genitourinary cancer section of the Southwest Oncology Group, an advanced disease survivor himself. Tony has run online discussion forums, live support groups, and is currently the president of US2 Las Vegas and a member at the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Supporting Mike on the panel, we have prostate cancer advocates Paul Carpenter. Paul has contributed to dozens of online groups and forums, and he co-founded a Los Angeles support group for gay and bisexual men living with prostate cancer. Alan Edel. Alan is a member of two prostate cancer support groups as well as online groups and often acts as a patient advocate in the Los Angeles area. Jan Manorait is a vice president of advocacy and education at PAACT, a prostate cancer advocacy organization founded in the early 80s. I extend a hearty welcome to everyone. Before I hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion, I would like to remind our listeners that you can send in your questions to me, Priya, at trialx.com or post it on curetalks.com website. If you would like to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad to let us know. With that, Mike, it's over to you. You're on air.
Thank you, Priya. I appreciate it. Welcome, everyone. Tony, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Excellent. So I want to spend as much time today as possible giving the panelists and also the audience time to ask you questions. But perhaps you'd like to take sort of 5 to 10 minutes just to tell us a little bit about your own prostate cancer and how you ended up becoming involved in so many of the different advocacy roles that you now have.
Certainly, Mike. I can relate back to the fateful day back in 2006, just a few days before the Christmas season. And I was told at that time that I had prostate cancer and went through, of course, all of the preliminary things that were available in 2006 and early 2007, as breaking down what it was that we wanted to do with my prostate cancer. It's important to note that it appeared at that time destined for treatment because I was 4 of 8 cores positive, and it was Gleason 7. So it was that in February of that year, I had robotic surgery, and that found bilateral seminal vesicle invasion. And bilateral seminal vesicle invasion, of course, was stage 3D. So we wanted to take some more precautionary steps. I went ahead and had hormonal therapy for a 28-month period, and about 120 days after the surgery, we began a protocol of 38 fractions of radiation therapy. I will say that from the moment that I was first detected with my PSA in August of that same year of 2006, I had a 20 PSA. The next test was 18. The next test was 17. And at that particular point, I had the surgery. I have never had a rise in PSA in my life. From the moment it was detected. Of course, it must have risen drastically in order to get to 20, but at that particular point, I'd never had a rise in PSA, and that includes after all therapies, and today I'm in remission. What I started to do right after diagnosis, though, is one of the things that changed my route in dealing with prostate cancer. And the first thing I figured out to do was to find online support groups, talk to my peers, get with people who have been on the road ahead and tell me what they saw coming back. And that was very helpful to me in being able to deal with my own disease. And it made me interested to continue to stay in that role as a mentor to others. And, you know, having as many treatments as I did, that would make me a mentor that at least had experienced a good number of treatment types. And HealingWell.com represented an outstanding forum for me. I stood there and moderated it for about 5 years, eventually leading to my meeting you yourself, Mike, but also leading to working more, trying to find ways to work with the live patients. And when the local man out here had retired, he came to me and asked me to start dealing with the live meeting situations. And Nick Vogelthang, who is one of the top researchers, his name might pop up more than once in this call, had come to me and asked me if I wanted to also participate in the Southwest Oncology Group as a patient representative. That was a little bit daunting to me when I first heard it because I didn't know what that person did. He told me I'd be fine. He told me that my knowledge was good and that my willingness to accept information was good, that he thought that that might be a great role for me. At that particular point, I was doing SWOG, I was doing CDMRP, I was doing a number of different programs that are out there. That's the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. And other types of advocacies I've been involved with included going to Capitol Hill, speaking on Capitol Hill, and in addition to that, representing NASPCC for the state of Nevada. So as it is, I've done pretty much just about all aspects of advocacy, but the one I find the most interesting is the Southwest Oncology Group and working on clinical trials.
So before we move on, just for the audience's benefit, I should point out Tony also somehow manages to hold down a full-time job. I'm not quite sure how he manages to do that too, but you know, maybe we can get into that later. Tony, I've got a couple of quick questions myself before I start opening it up to the rest of the panel. The first one is, how do you go about making sure in all of these actions that you take that you aren't just expressing your own opinion, but you're doing everything you can to represent the community as a whole?
It didn't start out that way. It's very easy to fall under the trap of believing in what you believe in, but then it didn't take me too terribly long to realize that the physicians that I was working with recognized that. They themselves fall into the same trap. And understanding that you have to open up the doors to a more broader point of view than your own leads you to kind of believe that, you know, some of the initial encounters I had and some of my initial positions that I took, they needed to be questioned. And I had to learn how to question them. And that's when I went on healthcare evidence-based medicine. And that made a substantial mark in how I can divide what I can still feel, but understanding that what I feel is not necessarily going to be helpful in this as much as it is going to be that what does everybody feel and what do we feel as a group that we can make a difference and properly move ahead without my opinions getting in front of me.
And what exactly are your responsibilities as the patient advocate for the GU section at SWOG?
You know, this was a piece that I didn't know exactly how to expect when I first went on into the first group meeting. They were very, very wonderful to me. They were very helpful to me in letting me know that we understand you understand a lot about prostate cancer. We understand you have a lot of connections and the networking capabilities of reaching on out to a lot of survivors. What do you see us doing in trials and stuff? And I immediately had to back up and be overwhelmed by the question because I didn't know how to answer that question. But in time, I learned to adapt within the group. Now, not all patient advocates can do this. Many patient advocates have had difficulty in integrating into their respective groups, be it breast cancer or multiple myeloma or whichever of the many different committees that are available at SWOG. Not all of the of the patient advocates were integrating into their group, but I found myself slipping right on in and integrating very well into the group. And my counterpart in the GU committee is Rick Bangs, who's a bladder cancer survivor. He also has the same approaches that I do, and we both agree that we are fully integrated. Now, what are our responsibilities? Our responsibilities are to be attentive and paying attention to each of the offered clinical trials that are coming down the pipe, making sure that the proper protocols are placed in facing the patient. When we get to facing the patient, we have to say, okay, is this test reasonable? Is it something that would be easy for somebody to do? Or is the ICF or the informed consent form worded in an easy enough way to understand it? And there are protocols that are in place to establish those things, but even with those protocols in place, they can get complex and get difficult for a patient to understand them. So it is that we, as the patient advocates, get on in there, get involved into the ICF portion of it. We do get involved into the trial design, but as much as that is, a lot of that is handled outside of the Southwest Oncology Group and handled by the National Cancer Institute. So understanding how those processes work, they expect me to understand those processes. They expect me to understand what the trial is trying to accomplish. What is the key question in the clinical trial? And are we getting to where we're not including enough people or we are including enough? Those are the kinds of things they would like us to participate with.
So one more question. I know you can't talk about trials that are in development or ongoing because you can't promote those, but are you able to give us an example of somewhere where you feel you've been able to help to make a trial better from a patient perspective?
Yeah. Over the last few years, we've heard of different call-outs for screening and doing baseline testing for men at the age of 40. Screening maybe in the 40s, but not necessarily at the 40. There was a trial that came on down. I immediately took a look at it and said, I don't like the trial because it's that its inclusion criteria would be men starting at the age of 45. And I had suggested to them we should include right on down to where we can detect these people, and that includes the age of 40 if they're doing baseline screening, and they fall under that criteria. The principal investigator agreed with me 100%. He made the change to the trial.
Excellent. So let's start with Paul, because I know Paul had spent a lot of time looking at different clinical trials and wondering why people were doing them or not doing them. So, Paul, what would you like to talk to Tony about?
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Mike. Thanks, Tony. Thanks. I find that clinical trials are very hard to explain to the layman, and I struggle with explaining why the criteria are in place, what the criteria mean. I wonder if there is anything afoot for helping a layman understand what the criteria are and why they are for some of the clinical trials that they may be considering enrolling in.
I think the best way, you know, to get back on over to a patient is to explain why the trial is being done. What is it trying to accomplish? You see, a lot of people look at clinical trials or enter clinical trials with the thought that this might be another form of treatment. But the whole point of a clinical trial is not to be another form of treatment. It is to answer a question. And you need to explain to the individual what the question is that's being asked and how the trial will be run from there. So, for example, if you have a trial that's going to be comparing one drug against another, that is typically a new experimental drug against a standard of care. So if the standard of care has already been established, we don't want to go back to the placebo level of doing the trial. We want to be able to do the trial with the standard of care, so either way the patient is still being helped. That is one aspect of doing it, and that would be in a drug-related type trial. In a trial maybe that's not drug-related, but for example, there was a trial on out about eating healthier and being able to follow a certain diet guideline. You have to be able to explain to them why, the trial is being done, and after a diagnosis, does eating healthier make you have a better fight against the cancer? Now, most people will say that's not too terribly difficult to understand, but you're right, Paul. When, as soon as you read the clinical trial and all the words in it, it can get very confusing to somebody very fast who has no experience in dealing with that. That's where we go back on over as an advocate and ask them to, make sure that language is very, very easy to understand in the informed consent form, but also give proper instructions back on over to those who will present that ICF to the patient on making sure that they understand each point of it. That's where we are with that. But there's also one other point to add. The NCTN has a advocacy network, and that's the National Clinical Trials Network. They have a group that's getting together right now, that's working right now on trying to standardize how that language should be presented to the patient.
Oh, very good. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. I did not know about that initiative.
Yeah, that is currently going on, and that will be going on through the remainder of this year. I think that probably by 2016, end of 2016, that we'll have a set of standards that must be applied in all of the co-ops and the NCI in order to try to standardize the language, because that is a major problem, is getting a standardized language on how to explain things.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you.
If I may interject quickly, Paul, I think also it's important for us to remember that most of the trials we see information about are through things like clinicaltrials.gov, and those have not been written for patients.
Yes.
They have been written for the professional community. The material that is actually handed to a patient in order to seek his informed consent is usually at least a little more intelligible.
I agree. And actually, I was thinking about bridging that gap when you have a patient saying, well, I think I might be interested in enrolling in a clinical trial. What could I do? And then all of a sudden they're faced with 150 possible things. They can't possibly look at all of the informed consent forms for each one. So they're picking and choosing, but often without the ability to understand.
Well, I think it's also important to note on that, Paul, is that the physicians that are working with this patient need to be properly selecting a clinical trial. I don't think that it's appropriate for a patient to look at a shopping list of clinical trials and then go back on over and choose which one they think might be best for them, but rather have the consensus from your medical team to go back on over. Is this trial appropriate for you at this time? Here's what's involved into doing this particular trial. Now, that stated, you bring up an interesting point in that at any given time, there might be more than one trial that fits a particular patient. And, of course, they always want to go with which one is best for them, and getting through that minutia and trying to figure out which one to select is very difficult to do. You can get a hold of the trial coordinators anytime you want. There is usually a phone number that is included in the clinical trial, and that phone number brings you to the trial coordinator and can help you also discuss with the trial coordinator, what is this trying to accomplish? Do I really fit this criteria? Am I properly in the inclusion criteria? And what is the hypothesis based upon?
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Anything else come to mind immediately, Paul?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Anything else come to mind immediately as a follow-up?
The criteria for inclusion, I know, I think this is also relating to a question that we got from a listener. Sometimes it's unclear how soft they might be, and there are rumors out there saying, well, I might be able to get you in through the back door. And I've not encountered that myself, but I'd be interested in hearing of what Tony's experiences are, whether things can be modified just a little to get someone in who doesn't quite meet the inclusion criteria.
Yeah, and I can give you a really solid example as well.
Uh-huh.
We have, for example, this one I can mention because I am published on this trial, but on uh-huh. S1216 is a trial from SWOG that is comparing order and all to the standard of care. Now, Ordronil is the TAC 700 component that many of us have probably read about in the past. It's being tested in a different setting than the previous trials, which it didn't fare so well. And in that setting, it's including men with presented with metastatic disease at their onset. And is this going to be a good trial to continue with, or is there another one that's out there that's better? Well, last ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, had the presentation from Chris Sweeney that came on out on the ECOG trial, which was done with SWOG, by the way, and it was called the CHARTED trial.
Right.
And the CHARTED trial, of course, was comparing the early use in this same patient set with chemotherapy, and presenting in that way showed that men with four metastatic lesions or visceral disease benefited highly from the early chemotherapy. Now, that affected our trial directly. So it would be that a patient who hears about that and then hears about this trial, should I not just go straight to the chemotherapy? Well, what SWOG did was we went back on over and changed our inclusion criteria so that there are patients who can still follow that, because that is now a standard of care and we have to subset them, but we are now including those patients that would qualify for that charted setting, and they can still stay within the setting of the 12-16 trial. So, yes, it's important to ask that trial coordinator, can I do this if I do this? And it's important to say the inclusion criteria are not always set in stone. For example, again, on 12-16, we started out with the need for the electrocardiograms every year on a patient. Well, that was too tasky for many patients. So we changed the criteria, and we reduced it to the number of occurrences of that particular event. And that is the kind of thing that, yeah, everybody has to remember. There are things that can be modified in a trial on the fly, as long as we get the proper okay from the National Cancer Institute, and everybody agrees in consensus that it will not harm the results of the trial, then we can make those modifications, and we can make exceptions for individual patients.
Well, thank you. That gives me some insight into the process that I was completely unaware of. So what I would say to someone who's not sure whether they could be, whether they meet the inclusion criteria, would be ask and maybe keep asking, because sometimes it does change. Sometimes the criteria evolve over time.
The key to asking probably includes who is doing the trial and can you get to the person that's coordinating that trial.
Right.
Typically, yes. The answer is yes. And typically, if you look at clinicaltrials.gov, you'll see who the principal investigator is, and you'll typically find out who the trial coordinator is as well.
Right.
So moving along, thank you, Paul.
Sure.
Alan, what sort of questions do you have for Tony with the immediate acknowledgement that SWOG does not do vast numbers of radiation therapy trials?
Actually, what I was going to ask Tony about is there. I have a little Tony Crispino sitting on my shoulder at all times, saying to me, "You don't know anything until we have a randomized controlled trial." It was very influential on Healing Well in putting that across. So, Tony, I was wondering if you could explain for listeners, what do we mean by the term levels of evidence, and why are randomized controlled trials so important?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there's important piece of this is the understanding the level of evidence that's out there. Typically, a level three level of evidence is it's basically considered more of an expert opinion, and many retrospective looks at hospital records or clinical records and such are typically a level three type of trials, where you go ahead and you develop a hypothesis based upon what you found in your setting. The problem with that particular level of trial is that it can be done on a sliding scale. It can include the criteria to which the investigator makes into it, and that is not really a trial. It's just basically a study. Now, level two is a little bit tighter in that it contains a lot more closely related information and even multi-level peer reviews that give the level two information a lot more foundation to arrive to a hypothesis that might be able to be presented into a level one trial. And a level one trial, we call it fact. Whether or not it's fact with which everybody would be looking for in the form of a fact, a level one trial is one with which has been stripped of bias as much as possible. Of course, I don't think that we could ever strip 100% bias in this industry, but it's been stripped of bias. It's added a randomization of not just the patients, but a randomization as to the institutes as well. So at SWOG, we are a 24-institute organization, and all of our institutions are pretty much IRB approved for SWOG trials, but any other locations with which might want to do it, trying to prove a point for a specific drug, you know, I think that we have to try our best to make sure that a level one trial is what's in place. Now, what are some of the examples of a level three hypothesis not proving well? There are so many of them. I mean, there were so many of them in the Vioxx world. Vioxx was being put out there, but then when it finally went to level one clinical trial, everybody found out that we were creating more heart conditions than we were solving with the Vioxx. And that can happen in the prostate cancer world just the same way. I think that it's important to note for a level one trial versus a level three opinion that at SWOG, we believe that about 90% of the level three conclusions are not 100% correct. And some of them are just not correct at all. And that led to the selenium and SELECT and PCPT trials, which showed the hypothesis that were out there on study at level three, none of them passed.
Hello?
So do you have any follow-up to that, Alan?
From the patient's point of view, and the patient typically, when they read about a study in the media, they don't know if it's level one evidence or level two or level three. All they know is some media said, for example, that baking soda and molasses will cure cancer, or last year media were saying things like it was pomegranate juice will do it. What do you say to patients who want to try some therapy or a diagnostic test just because they read about it on the internet?
Well, I tell you, my thoughts about the internet and the gathering of information is very cautious. As you already know, Alan, as you mentioned even, I believe if it's not a level one trial, it's more susceptible to error. It's a major issue. But when we get to start talking about the media, we're not even talking about level one, two, or three. We're talking about somebody doing the reporting. And that somebody doing the reporting is typically not even a physician. Sometimes it is, but typically it's not even a physician. You know, if you can make something sound better than it was or something that might capture people's interest, that's what the media is after. They're not after the same thing that we are over in the clinical trial side, where we're trying to prove that molasses has an effect on somebody, or deferring back to the SWOG trial, selenium and vitamin E in the SELECT trial, where it was stated and reported back in the early 90s that taking high amounts of selenium and vitamin E will prevent you from getting prostate cancer. Not only when it was put into trial was it not true, but it also showed an example of where you may be doing more harm than good. And at that particular point, we ended that trial and said that we don't need to go any further because we know we're doing more harm than good. Well, that didn't get as much press as it was getting before that, when the press was reporting that selenium and vitamin E were great ways to help avoid prostate cancer. But we know that's not true now. We know that there are reasons that maybe some were suggesting it, such as maybe a reduction in the number of detections, but the reality was that those who were taking high amounts of vitamin E were actually having higher rates of aggressive prostate cancer.
I think also it's worth noting that in defense of the media, many very respectable institutions spend a great deal of time publicizing the results of very early stage research as part of their strategy to raise the next round of money to do the next round of research. And so there's an awful lot of material that gets out onto the internet and even into the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal that is really hypothesis generating, and it is not actually a study designed to prove whether something works or not. But it may get presented in a way that makes it look as though it's clinically meaningful. And this is one of the complexities of you know, having access to the internet for all of us. You can't look at what's on the internet and assume that it's true any more than you can look at, you know, somebody's review of a film and say that he must be right. He may like that film. You may go and see it and think it's terrible. And there's a large element to that in how one understands and assimilates scientific information as well.
Yeah, Mike, I agree with that. I think that a lot of our own bias gets into the equation. And when our own bias gets into the equation, it makes it easier to digest what we hear in the media if it's what we want to hear. And if it's not necessarily so much, it makes it harder to push it back and say, I don't believe that. I think that a lot of people have to remember that the biggest enemy to evidence-based medicine is always and typically bias. And it happens not just at our patient levels, which we talk about all the time at healingwell.com, about, you know, if you talk to a radiation oncologist, he's going to do radiation. If you talk to a surgeon, he's going to do surgeon. The medical professionals have the same issue. And they have to deal with their own biases as well. So when they develop these hypotheses, they release them to the media, it gets into conversation generating. The fact is that there's really no way to come back on over until that level one trial is done to state whether or not the entire statement is true. In fact, it could be entirely false. Sadly, it could also be true. In so many years, we've done the rejection in the cancer industry about complementary alternative medicine approaches to dealing with cancers. And physicians for many years wrote them off, that basically there is no such thing as integrative oncology. Well, that's changed too over time. We've seen that that has changed because, as was mentioned earlier about eating well and doing physical therapy, physical exercising, you build up your body's immune system and you create the opportunity to go ahead and fight the cancer better. But for many years, if you walk into Harvard University and you said, I think that exercise and diet is going to play an important role in this patient, they would have laughed you off.
So with that, we move to ask Jan if he's got a couple of questions, because Jan spent more time trying to simplify all of this for patients than the rest of us put together, I suspect. Jan?
Thank you. Yeah, you know me, Mike, because I lived in this space, like, hi, Tony, like Tony has for so long, you know, I kept hitting brick walls and feeling overwhelmed and confused, and so my passion has always been to just help people with clear information, and I use phrases like, if we're going to share the decisions, we must share the information. So with clinical trials, let me back up. I want to go back to a comment about the internet for patients, in case there are any patients or caregivers listening. It is hard to find accurate information. There's a few flags you can look for, like if somebody's selling something, trying to make a case that they're unbiased is just unreasonable. But I'm going to go so far, Mike, as to say that I've found the Prostate Cancer Info link to be a consistent source of understandable, valid information. So I don't know if you're allowed to give that out, but I'd be happy to give out the new prostate cancer info link as a good source of information. I wonder if the other panelists would agree.
Well, I can say from my perspective, yes.
Yeah, I agree too.
We try hard, but I am very conscious that sometimes I am biased about things. I have opinions, and they get in the way of total
that's
neutrality.
A good, yeah. Well, that just says right there that you're probably less biased than other people. But I'd like to at least give listeners, instead of telling them, you know, what the internet cannot do, give them one place that maybe they could go. I mean, let's face it, right now we're on the internet, you know, and we're trying to give good information. So
sure.
Let's give them something good.
And also,
Jen,
I'd like to follow up. One of the things that Mike does, he says, yes, I know I have some biases sometimes. And when he writes something and he knows he has a bias, he says, my bias is as follows, but that's what my bias is.
Everything so I agree.
That he presents as
yeah.
fact is evidentiary fact that one can track down where he got that information from. So, yes.
Yeah.
Keep
so
doing
you can
what
go to the new prostate cancer info link and just search that site if you have an issue that you want to try and find some clear information on. And for the most part, it's really vast and usually understandable and fairly unbiased. I think that's really fair. So
yeah.
Well, thank you, folks. I appreciate
yeah.
that. And so does Tony. So does Alan too. Because he'll be doing a lot.
And then moving on to, you know, understanding clinical trials. Paul, you were addressing that. And one perspective I think that helps is not focusing on the clinical trial, but focusing on the patient. And all they really want to know is this a clinical trial for me? And a good direction I found to take that is a simple risk versus benefit perspective and discussion. And the risks in the trial may be, you know, does it have placebo? And people still think that all clinical trials have placebo, and they don't. So you need to ask or you need to find out. And we're in an age now where a lot of placebo-driven trials have two-thirds of the men on the drug and only one-third on placebo. So that lessens the risk for the patient. In addition, some of those trials have an actual crossover provision, and that's a key word, crossover. What that means is if you get the placebo and you don't even know it and your disease progresses, if there's a crossover provision, they cross you over either to standard of care or the trial drug or something else. So all of a sudden this risk column becomes minimized, and that's what the patient wants to know. So those are some of the key questions I think that help. And second, if they know what they have as far as their cancer, if they have their medical records, they're going to have better questions and be able to evaluate risk and benefit better. So instead of trying to convince them that the trial is this or that, I want to help them understand their risk versus benefit so they can make a decision. So just some thoughts on that.
Which raises an interesting question, Tony. Is that something that gets specifically discussed during the trial design phase and how that is going to get presented to the patient?
Absolutely, it does. It comes down, you know, there's a couple of aspects of what Jan pointed out there. Being, you know, there's a trial sometimes is comparing with a placebo, minimizing the effect of the placebo to improve the trial outcome. And then also, to do something else that's very important to a trial. When you include a placebo into a trial, almost invariably, it's going to run the risk of that trial failing. And the failure of a trial is not that it didn't prove a drug was working or a drug was not working. That is a successful trial. The trial that ends with accrual, and in the accrual, we've met the criteria of all of the biostatistics that had to be accomplished, and we arrived at an answer. No, this drug does not work. That's not a failed trial. That's a successful trial. A failed trial happens when you have an inclusion criteria that is tough to meet, or and you can't make the accrual criteria, and therefore you won't be able to arrive at the desired answer. Or a failed trial can also be to which it was flawed by design. And by design, the trial itself had to be pulled back off of the table. Now, we see clinical trials fail And those are the worst kind. Those are the ones that cost the medical industry a lot of money. So they're from being in there. And if they can take that standard of care and substitute it with the placebo, CTEP, which is a very important arm of the National Cancer Institute, must review it. And CTEP is the Clinical Trial Evaluation Program. And if they go on through and they agree that they can substitute a placebo with a standard of care, it will help a trial be successful because the accrual rate will be much higher.
So I have one more question before we move on and open this up to the audience. We are now in the situation where we have multiple drugs already available. Many of them are being tested earlier in the disease. And there are literally dozens of other drugs coming down the pipeline which are going to have to go through the phase 2 and phase 3 trial process. How much effort is made to be quite sure we're going to be able to enroll enough patients into those trials before SWOG is willing to get involved? Because SWOG is the group that does the majority of the prostate cancer trials. ECOG is much more involved in other disorders, as are some of the other trial groups.
May I comment on that, or is that for Tony?
Well, it's for Tony, but if you've got a comment, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to, because I, you know me, Mike, I write about this. I take clinical trials, I sort of handpick a few, and then I pull out what I call basic eligibility criteria, and I've been blogging about them on the PACT website. Am I allowed to mention our website?
Sure. Well, you just
okay.
did, so yes.
That's not really fair because I already mentioned yours, so I put
I'm
you on
teasing
the spot.
You. Yes, of course you are.
Okay, it's PAACTUSA.org, PACTUSA.org. On that website, you'll find our blog, and I have right now three different clinical trials on there in plain English that I thought were very interesting. One is a ProstVac immunotherapy trial for newly diagnosed or active surveillance, which I think is super interesting. Again, two-thirds drug, only one-third placebo. There's the Aramis trial and the Spartan trial also, which are for men who are on hormone therapy, rising PSA, and no metastasis. So they're on there in plain English right now. You can go there and find information that helps you, and it takes you to the official site.
If we go back to my question, Tony, how much effort do the trial groups themselves make to make sure that they think they will be able to enroll patients?
It is almost imperative that that's decided before we encapsulate it and send it on over to CTEP. We have to feel that we can make the trial work or it's not going to go. And whatever has to be done, and this is where those biostatisticians, the people who think with numbers well beyond calculus, are going back on over and looking what the population would require for to get an answer, what kind of variants can get involved into that. We have to get into those levels of discussion in order to make sure that we're going to reach the accrual. If we don't think that we're going to reach the accrual, and it does not appear that we're going to reach the accrual, we may be able to go back to the manufacturers and figure out what we need to do and maybe make the accrual happen. But you're right. With so many of the different drugs that are coming on down, and the more drugs that come on down, the more competition is going to be in various settings for clinical trials. And that, of course, is going to make it more and more difficult as time moves on to define which is the appropriate trial. Is it the right one for me? And if not, I'm not going to do it. And if everybody else feels the same way, a trial that might actually be better than some of the others is going to fall because we can't reach the accrual numbers. And that is a failed trial. And we have to do everything within our means to meet the inclusion criteria and meet the accrual criteria. And that is how our meetings go. I mean, we'll sit around and we'll talk about that and say, well, you know, what is it going to take in order for these people to participate in this trial when, in fact, it competes maybe with active surveillance? And most people would rather do nothing.
I'm curious, Tony. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Paul, but can we keep it quick because I want to get us out to the other audience as soon as we can.
Of course. I was just curious, how do you get the word out to physicians and clinics to say, hey, Let's recruit. Let's recruit harder because we're failing to meet the accrual goals.
Well, a lot of the problems that make that happen, Paul, are not the smell or taste of the trial from the patient standpoint. Everybody has to understand that any institution that is going to offer the clinical trial has what they call an investigational review board, an IRB. Many times we're not hitting our numbers because the IRBs are sitting on it, and they're not making a decision to say, okay, Cleveland Clinic will do this trial, or okay, Johns Hopkins will do this trial. Each of these investigational review boards will have to then work with our group, which has an investigational review board, and with CTEP, which has an investigational review board, and take out the concerns that are preventing them from accepting the trial and offering the trial at their institution. And then you have to get back down to the physician level. At that
right.
particular point, do they have the physicians at that institution that maybe aren't conflicted by another trial and would be more likely to participate in that particular trial with their institution? There's a lot of little things like that that get involved into making the number happen for accrual. The key to accrual is a very simply and well-stated and outlined trial and has significant benefits to the patient themselves. And if we
yes.
can get all of the description done in that way, usually participate if it fits their need, and if not, they'll go ahead and move on, and we'll need to hear why they selected no.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So at this
Thank
point,
you.
Priya, what I would like to do is hand this back over to you so that you can help patients who are listening to the call to ask their questions.
Thank you, Mike. We have a list of questions actually sent in via email and posted on our website right now. Tony, I'll just quickly go over them. You may have to repeat some of the things that we have actually already discussed, but I'll try to keep that to the minimum. We have a listener asking, what are the challenges you face as a prostate cancer advocate? He says, were there incidences or some tough emotional circumstances where you wish you could help the person you're dealing with but felt helpless?
Oh, many times over.
Yes.
You know, I can't state enough as a prostate cancer patient that feeling of hopelessness that I had when I got started out. It took an education to get myself to be able to come to grips with it. And by that, I had to find out how to educate myself, which starting from the ground up, it was very difficult. To every patient that I would say that goes through the experience of a diagnosis of cancer, discussion with your peers is very helpful. But in all of the courses that I run for the Us2 group or anywhere online, it is education is the key. You don't want to make emotional decisions. You want to make educated decisions. And if anybody's diagnosed with prostate cancer, don't feel alone. Go out and find the people that aren't alone and join them in the conversation, and it'll definitely help ease some of the fears that you might face.
This is Jan. Can I interject? I think
sure
one thing
can.
I found really helpful is men are trying to make treatment decisions, but they don't know what they have because every prostate cancer is different. So go backwards before you go forward and get your medical records, get a basic understanding of them, and then you will know what type of prostate cancer you have, which helps you decide the type of research and conversations you need.
The
Thank you,
toughest challenge I've faced is that I'm so much into evidence-based medicine, becoming informed, knowing what the risks are down to two decimal points if I can, and when I'm faced with someone who honestly doesn't want to become educated, they want some charismatic person to just tell them what to do, and I feel helpless in the face of that because I just think that's a wrong way of proceeding, but I'm not about to tell them, well, choose wisely whom you trust. Sorry, I can't help you. I feel helpless.
If I may, as a patient advocate, my goal is not to tell the patient what his cures are, although I may give him a lot of options to discuss with his doctor. But my goal is to empower the patient to get him to a point where he can talk to the right doctors and ask the right questions. And if the patient advocate sees that as his goal rather than curing the patient, I think he'll be a lot less frustrated.
I'm with you on that, Ellen.
What I was talking about
was the situation where a patient doesn't want to learn. They want to be instructed by someone they trust.
I wasn't responding to you.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone. The next question I'll turn out of the panel. We'll start with Tony, and I hope everybody can give in their thoughts on this. The question is, are many trials fail to enroll enough patients, leading to increase in cost or even cancellation of the trials? Being a patient advocate for many years, what changes would you like to see in the patient recruitment process or efforts?
That is a terrific question. The first part of that question is, cost. We didn't get any time to talk about that, but like everything else in this world, it seems like the top three layers of decision-making to go ahead and move forward with something is preferential, political, and financial, and the financial typically being at the top of the list. Clinical trials are very, very expensive. It's very difficult to put out a trial that studies active surveillance over a 15, 20-year period and be able to have it as a phase one trial. You're typically going to have to always go back on those trials because nobody's going to fund it. It's going to be very expensive to come back on over and follow patients for 15, 20 years to be able to arrive at a conclusive answer in the trial that this person was better than this person for active surveillance, yet they were both the same at diagnosis. I think that a lot of this stuff is also going to continue to change as we move forward. How that changes the complexity of funding for trials is still yet to be seen, but I know when Maha Hussein was on this show, specifically talked about what is the next phases of what we got to accomplish in the research side, and it's translational medicine, which is the process of taking the genomics, assigning it to a targeted approach for individualized care to each patient. That is great. It's novel, but it's very, very, very expensive. I'd like to see it changed, that the funding from the federal government considers going back on into this. I mean, the federal government funded the SELECT and the PCPT trials because of where they were at the time, and that funding from them made those two of the largest trials in cancer research history be able to get completed. And if it wasn't for the $134 million that was dumped into those trials, it would never have happened. So where do you come back on over and get the funding for a trial that is really, really necessary to get done, such as the following of the active surveillance core or the following of early detection, and did we need to treat this guy? Did we not need to treat this guy? Those are the types of things that I would like to see improved in the future and to help us provide a more definitive answer so that here's your Gleason score, here's your PSA, here's the number of course positive. What do you want to do? That I'm not happy with.
Tony, do you think that the development of registry systems is really going to help with this, or is it a step in the right direction that's not going to go far enough?
I think a little of both, probably leaning towards your last part, because we don't have a criteria for that was established by that database and its gathering of information. We definitely don't want to end up in a scenario with which we throw everybody into a bucket, and then depending on how you set your sliding scale, these are the results. But I think that it will help a great deal to have a database. That database also, coming to recognize the direction that we're going, is also going to need to include tissue banking for that individual that's in the database so that we can get a retrospective view of what he was looking like when he was diagnosed and what he's looking like today, 20 years later.
Jan,
anybody else
would you
want to comment on that question?
Yeah.
Okay, Priya, on you go.
Hi. Yep, okay. The next question is, what is the biggest fear of a patient about participating in a clinical trial that you have come across during practicing advocacy?
biggest fear I see coming across patients entering a clinical trial is the uncertainty. Simply put, if they understand the trial well and they're in a trial that's for late-stage prostate cancer, their fears are probably a lot different than if it's a trial examining early-stage prostate cancer and taking a look at the use of some of the novel new hormonal therapies that we have out there being used in that setting. I think the biggest fear I see in a prostate cancer patient entering a clinical trial is the disease progression itself. And is it going to progress? Is it not going to progress? What do I do? What do I not do? Some people don't like the idea of being randomized. Most people like control, and they would like to be in control of their decision-making processes. However, that said, a patient that would like to test, I'm going to go backwards in time here so I don't step on anything that we're currently working on, XL184. I know many guys that were going on into that trial, but what they had to fear was far worse than the trial itself. Their disease was progressing, and this was a disease. This was a drug being tested in a very late stage of the disease. And, their fear is that they'll never know if it helped them or not. And then the second part of it is that the moment it starts to fail, they feel the need to get out of that trial and do something different.
Yeah. Thank you, Tony. Just one more question. The listener wants to know that I want to help the prostate cancer patient community by becoming a prostate cancer advocate. Where do I start? And do I need special training for becoming a patient advocate?
May I interject?
Okay.
Sure, Jen, sure.
Yeah. Because we all are advocates here, but I would say the best way to be advocate is to just be yourself. And I would say also that whatever caused you the greatest amount of pain that you overcame is probably exactly where you need to advocate. And that's what I mean by being yourself. For me, it was misinformation, incorrect information, and missing information. So that's where I focus. That caused us a lot of stress. So I try to make a difference right there. It can be as big or small as you want. Just find a way to be yourself in your own space from where you struggled and conquered.
I think that's a very good point, Jen. And I mean, it's interesting because you raised the whole question of impartialness and impartiality before. I mean, the thing I felt and the reason that I got so involved was because I felt that the information being presented to patients nearly always seemed to represent somebody's point of view,
right,
as opposed to just representing the factual evidence that was available. I know that others of us have also sort of come at this from the areas that we felt underserved by. But the other thing
that
I would say
to anybody, frustration. Right.
The other thing I would say to somebody who wants to learn to become an advocate is find yourself a mentor. Find somebody who has already taken steps, like as we have, as others have. The easiest place to start might well be with your local support group leader, but find somebody who you can talk to and who you can discuss things that you don't understand with and things as you learn, and so that you have another sounding board to work with.
But I'm going to interject. I know we're running at the last minute here. The one key training that I thought was very valuable to me was the evidence-based medicine one, and it was taught by another advocate, Musa Meyer, who is with the PAIR Network and also with the Crockering Collaboration, has put together a series of training videos with which teach you how to compare the information that you're hearing and be able to go ahead and decipher between it and ask the right questions. I think a good patient advocate will always be following that kind of criteria. And, Mike, I'll forward you that information because it's open to the public. And if you want to get that on the InfoLink site, I think that'd be a great idea. But it is a very intense training course. They say to take a couple of months to do it. I was able to do it in less than a month. I was able to do it in a few weeks, but that was only because I didn't start at the go line.
Well, thank you, everybody, for your time this evening. I think we've covered a lot of ground, and I really appreciate everybody's help. Priya, perhaps you'd like to do the wrap-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I feel over the hour we have shared valuable information regarding training, learning, clinical trials, and how to become an advocate, and I think this was very helpful. Patient advocates are a great resource to connect with, so patients and caregivers who are looking for information. So thank you very much, Tony, Paul, Alan, Jan, and Mike, for sharing all this great information with our audience. This talk will be made available on CureTalks website along with a transcript. Please visit curetalks.com for details of upcoming talks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.